Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Casey Sepp, author of Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, published by Knopf in May, her first book. Reverend Willie Maxwell, he's a man who loved life insurance. He loved it so much that in the 70s he took out, I guess, scores of policies, inuring him to the benefits of the payouts, and then meticulously murdered, and I guess allegedly murdered, five of his family members in order to collect on those policies. Kind of miraculously, with the help of an amazing lawyer, he escaped conviction for all of them, and his life of largesse only ended when he was shot dead at the funeral of his last victim. I don't know who collected on his policies. Weirdly and incredibly, the same lawyer who defended Willie successfully obtained an acquittal for the murder of Willie. It's a strange justice system. But the crux of this book is really not about Willie. It's about Harper Lee, the author of one of the most beloved books in modern American literature. She was going to write a book about Willie. She even sat in the audience at Willie's trial. But then, and we learn why, that book never happened. So in addition to being a fantastic look at a fascinating story, we also obtain a wealth of information and understanding of this elusive woman, Harper Lee. So with that, welcome, Casey, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to get to talk about the book and to get to talk about Harper Lee, a writer I think a lot of us just know and love.
You know, and that's interesting because, you know, most epigraphs aren't written by the person who the book is about. And your epigraph is simply her saying, "We are bound by a common anguish." Your epigraph in her words. So what did they mean to you in the book, and what did they mean to her?
Yeah, I mean, those are great questions. And interestingly enough, I not only took the epigraph from Harper Lee, but also the title. So Furious Hours comes from a lecture she gave in the 1980s about Alabama history. And that phrase, "We are bound by a common anguish," comes from an interview she gave in the 70s. Strangely enough, it was with People magazine, and they were writing a profile of Truman Capote, and Harper Lee had been telling stories about their childhood, because incredibly, these two very different but very remarkable writers spent much of their childhood together. She was born in Monroeville, Alabama, and he had some extended family there. So he spent a few years, and then even into his teens, spent some summers there. So they knew each other quite well. And on reflecting on their childhood, that's what she said: "We are bound by a common anguish." And she didn't explain more than that. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of potential meanings. On the one hand, they were both incredibly intellectual children and kind of set apart, as Capote said, from their peers. They like to read, they like to write stories, they like to tell stories, they like to think deeply about, you know, the community they were being brought up in. And certainly that set them apart and might have left them feeling anguished because they had each other but were so removed from the other children. Another meaning, and one that, you know, quite a lot of people have speculated about as I've gotten to talk about the book, is obviously to some extent they were both tortured writers. So she suffered with writer's block, he struggled with addiction, and the anguish might well have just been their chosen vocation and how hard it was for them to live into. You know, another option is the kind of queer position both of them had. So he was out and well known for being gay and happy to talk about it and happy to write about it. And she herself never married and lived a kind of genderqueer life for a woman of her time and place. And so that might have anguished them too. But I love the epigraph because it's classic Harper Lee. It says so much without saying anything specifically at all. You know, it's so ambiguous and indeterminate and also just quite beautiful that I knew it was the epigraph because I felt it was so appropriate for her. But it also offered a kind of argument about what the book was going to do, which was look at what these three people have in common. So it's not only her story, it's this original crime story. And, you know, by using that epigraph, I would get to say, like, you don't think these people have anything in common, but actually they do, because we all have something in common. So that's why I chose it. And I hate to dodge the question, but I sort of like the way she said it and never explained it. So I like that it sort of speaks to a lot of different things in the book, including her life.
And the thing about it is that you also involve the reader with that epigraph and with the book, because, you know, it's like, when I think about we're all bound by a common anguish, all these ideas come into my head. It's like somebody saying most men live lives of quiet desperation, and you...
Oh, totally. I think that's quite beautiful.
Yeah, and it's just... And that's what good books do, is that, you know, the reader becomes a part of it, and the reader asks him or herself the questions that are also asked in the book, and then they have to decide whether they have the courage to come up with the answer, or they're just going to kind of avoid it. Which reminds me, since you're so fast, obviously, listen to your last answer, you're so fascinated with all of this, but it's your first book, so give the listeners an idea of, one, how the idea for this came into your head, and at the same time, maybe, well, because we're trying to sell your book, too, give us a synopsis of the book itself.
Yeah, so I would be happy to explain where the idea came from. And, you know, the long and the short of it is, I think that here we are talking about Harper Lee's childhood and Truman Capote's childhood. I think that for a lot of writers, you know, there is one book when they were children, and it made them want to be a writer, and it gave them kind of a new way of thinking about their life and about character and about setting. And that book for me was Mockingbird, and I loved it, and I loved the character of Scout Finch, and I was so interested in Makem. And, you know, I read the book and I saw the movie, and that was my book. And I read it over and over again, and I like to think about it, and I return to it a lot as an adult. And I had always wanted to see the town where Harper Lee was born and raised, because I knew it was the model for Makem. So I had wanted to go to Monroeville and never had a chance to. But when Ghost at a Watchman was announced in 2015, I went down to report on that for The New Yorker. And while I was there, I found out about this true crime book she'd tried to write. And it was so interesting. You know, the original case was so fascinating. So you kind of beat the bounds of the story. There's this series of murders in a small town in Alabama. The purported motive was insurance fraud. Allegedly, a Baptist minister had murdered several of his family members. Incredibly, he was murdered at the funeral of his last victim. And the same attorney who had defended him in criminal court and actually represented him over and over again in civil court to get the insurance companies to pay out those policies, then defended the vigilante who murdered his former client. And on top of all that, you know, here was Harper Lee, who came to town to try and write her own In Cold Blood about it. And I was gripped, and I was fascinated. And I thought, here's this writer I thought I knew so much about, and I didn't know the half of who Harper Lee was as a writer or a thinker or a legal scholar. And I just, you know, I was so interested, wanted to know more, and it turned out, you know, some of the original case files were available. A lot of the people who had lived through these crimes and met Harper Lee when she was in town working on her book were still around. And there was just more and more and more. And finally, it seemed like enough to write a book. So the book grew out of that original reporting for The New Yorker.
This is somewhat off track, I guess, but since you mentioned it, and we talked briefly about it a little bit before the broadcast, I have mixed feelings about Ghost at a Watchman, and I have to confess that most of them are negative. I've read about how it happened, how it was released, but tell me a little bit about, obviously, you know, pretty much know everything about it. What do you think happened, and do you think it was worthwhile releasing it?
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of your listeners, look, my experience doing book events for my book is, you know, half the people who love Harper Lee read Ghost at a Watchman, and the other half, you know, will never open the pages of the book. And I think for the half who did read it, they learned a lot about her. And I think that it's a little grievous the way Watchman was published. For a lot of people, they thought it was truly a sequel to To Kill a Mockingbird, and that Harper Lee in her prime, you know, had slaved over this manuscript for decades, and finally we were getting her second book. And I understand that confusion, because temporally Ghost at a Watchman takes place after To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, Scout is aged up. She's coming home from New York to visit her family. Atticus is quite old. You know, we've moved forward. It's set in the 1950s, not the 1930s. But it's a very complicated manuscript history. And of course, what most people know if you go researching it is that actually Ghost at a Watchman is the first book Harper Lee ever wrote. And it's not a writer at the height of her powers. It's literally the first draft she ever tried to set to paper. And then a very talented editor at Lippincott met her, read the book, and helped her craft the story that became To Kill a Mockingbird. So I think it's a little tragic that so much of the American reading public was left thinking that Harper Lee, a writer they loved, had become a lesser writer, and that at the end of her life she had produced kind of a messy, unsatisfying book. And I think that, you know, if it had been published differently, if it had had a preface explaining the manuscript history, if it had had an introduction by someone who studies Southern history and Southern political history, who could have explained the Dixiecrat movement and what happened to a lot of men like Atticus Finch, it would have been a real gift to people who love her work. And it would have been a very interesting look at how editors can help writers make better books than their first attempt. You know, we tell stories like this all the time. It's Maxwell Perkins helping Thomas Wolfe, or, you know, helping F. Scott Fitzgerald or Hemingway. You know, most writers love editors, and they're really beautiful stories of collaboration. And I think that that would have been the better story to tell about Ghost at a Watchman. But the kind of hysteria around, oh, wow, a new book by Harper Lee was a little too good to pass up. And that's the message that a lot of readers were sold, even in the way the book was packaged. So I think that, you know, it could have been done better. There could have been, you know, a more sophisticated story told for readers, even something like what you see with, you know, sometimes a writer like Elizabeth Bishop, where, you know, drafts and fragments are published, someone writes the kind of annotations that explain to folks where those poems came from and her revision process. Anything like that would have been useful so that people who love Harper Lee could simply appreciate the relationship between the two books and not think, oh, this was a standalone project that she wanted in the world. So that's the kind of complicated answer, but I definitely think it's worth reading. I just don't think anyone should read it with the idea that this represents Harper Lee at the height of her powers. I think they should read it thinking, oh, wow, as a young woman in New York City, never having taken a creative writing class, never having published anything outside of the college literary magazine and newspaper, here was the young Harper Lee trying to figure out how to write a novel. And once she wrote this draft, she met an editor who helped her do a better version of the story.
Yeah, I guess the thing that bothers me is that for little girls and little boys, like the little girl you were, reading on your own and then being assigned in fourth, fifth, sixth grade the same book, and then seeing the movie and Atticus being your hero, and then you read Ghost at a Watchman and he's not what you think he was, and he's in your mind so indelibly inked, and then all of a sudden you read this and something changes, right?
Sure. I mean, I definitely think, you know, if that's how it happens, it can feel really tragic. On the other hand, you know, again, if you think about the kinds of people who write about, you know, mid-century politics, and obviously in my book, Furious Hours, that's a little bit of what I'm doing, because there's a lawyer at the heart of the book who actually served in the Alabama state legislature and was big in the Democratic Party. It doesn't make Atticus into much of a hero, but it makes him into a really interesting historical figure, and he's worth reckoning with as we think about racial politics today, because what Harper Lee knew from her own experience is that there were plenty of Southern white men who would never have joined a lynch mob, but they were not pro-integration. And they devoted a lot of their time and energy to trying to keep African-American neighbors out of collective spaces, to try and keep them from prospering, to really, you know, kind of soft pedal white supremacy. And I think, you know, in that sense, it's a very important book to read today. Now, it's probably not a book for elementary or middle school students. And I think one of the interesting things that's happening with To Kill a Mockingbird is it's slowly moving up the syllabi. So instead of reading it in middle school, you know, you might take a graduate seminar on American political history and you would read both versions of the novel and talk about it.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually. Well, go ahead, continue, and like I said, give us a bit more. But see, and all the reviews, well, they're all praiseworthy, but the ones that really get into it, they're fascinated and also find it almost unique that you bring Harper Lee into the book. especially one person who said, I forgot where I read it, like she said, the last 20 pages just, you know, holy mackerel, I had no, you know, it just got to me. And, you know, so go ahead, tell us a little bit about Willie and what happened, and then about Harper and her being there.
Yeah, I should say right off the bat, and I tend to say this at book events too, you know, if you're in it for Harper Lee, I would just ask you to be patient.
Yeah.
Because she, you know, she shows up at the very beginning, and I kind of set the scene of this trial, but then she disappears as she was wont to do. And so, you know, if you're in it for Harper Lee, I promise it's worth waiting for. I'm trying to teach you things about, you know, the context she grew up in and what Alabama was like during her childhood and during her adolescence, and, you know, to give you all the information so you can appreciate what a hard book she set herself to try and write. But it is kind of, you know, logistically true that she doesn't show up again until the final third. So just be patient if you're in it for Harper Lee, because the first two thirds of the book are about this original true crime story. And, you know, the thing to say is Harper Lee knew a good story when she found one. And this is a case that unfolded between 1970 and 1977 in eastern Alabama on one of these incredible man-made reservoirs. You know, there are these great lakes all around the South that were created during the kind of hydroelectric craze, and they would dam these rivers and build these hydroelectric power plants. And it meant that the towns could mechanize, and a lot of these textile mill towns just really prospered. And that was Alex City. And, you know, a lot of people got rich, but some of them didn't. And some of the folks who didn't get rich were the rural African-Americans who basically moved from sharecropping into working class jobs in the mills. And one of the men who did that was this guy, Willie Maxwell. And he was most famous for his preaching, but he worked in a textile mill in town, and he worked at a rock quarry in town, and he had actually been a distinguished serviceman during World War II. But he came home to Alabama, and eventually, after 20 years of a seemingly happy marriage where he ministered on the side and had all those other jobs around Lake Martin, he was then accused of killing his first wife. And, you know, the police charged him right away, but he didn't go to trial for a while. And the truth is, the law enforcement folks around Lake Martin were shocked when he was acquitted, because they had a star witness, a neighbor of his, who was supposed to say that he had called his wife and lured her out of the house, and that, you know, he was gone all night. So when her dead body was found on the side of a rural road near where he had allegedly called her to, the neighbor was going to not only, you know, do away with his alibi, but make it clear that he was the most likely suspect. And on top of some other circumstantial evidence they had found at the scene, they were pretty sure they could get a conviction. Well, it turned out that that neighbor changed her testimony, and the police couldn't figure out why until a few months later she became the second Mrs. Maxwell. And a few years after that, she was also found murdered under similar circumstances. And by 1977, two of the reverend's wives, one of his brothers, one of his nephews, and then even a teenage stepdaughter of his were all found dead under similar circumstances, and he held lucrative life insurance policies on all of them. So at the funeral of that last victim, a 16-year-old girl, another relative of hers stood up in the funeral home chapel and shot the reverend three times in the face. And that man was tried for the reverend's murder, but as we talked about before, he was defended by the same attorney who had represented the reverend for 10 years, represented him in all the police investigations, represented him in all the civil trials where he sued the insurance companies to get the payoffs. Because, of course, the insurance companies, even more than the police, wanted him to be held responsible and didn't want to have to pay out these lucrative policies. And it was at that trial of the vigilante, of the man who murdered the Reverend Willie Maxwell, that Harper Lee showed up in town. Having heard about the case earlier that year, she comes to the trial, buys a copy of the transcript, starts interviewing all the lawyers and all the law enforcement officers and all of the relatives of the victims of the Reverend Willie Maxwell, gathering all these documents, doing all of this reporting, telling everyone in town she was going to write a nonfiction book about the case. So that's why she shows up at the last third of the book, because, of course, so much has happened even before she arrives on the scene. And her part of the story is in trying to make meaning out of that case and in trying to turn it into a book and trying to figure out how stories like this one, stories of violence in a small town, can actually be made meaningful or be made to tell a bigger story about how we live with one another and how we survive violence and how crime can be made meaningful. And of course, she knew how to do that because she'd helped Capote do it with In Cold Blood almost 17 years before.
Well, that's the thing, too. When we talked a little bit about their friendship and the how odd it was and amazing that they grew up together. But okay, so what created the rift? What liberties did Truman take that Harper found, if she did find them, repellent? And what made her so angry about what he had done in that book, which makes other people angry too?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So, you know, here we are talking about the experience a lot of us have as we read To Kill a Mockingbird as children. Obviously, a lot of young reporters, whether it's in high school or college or journalism school, are given In Cold Blood and told that it is the pinnacle of nonfiction writing. And of course, what Harper Lee knew, because she had been involved in the reporting, you know, she had accompanied Capote to Kansas several times. She had interviewed all the key players. She had been there when he had interviewed Hickok and Smith and had an ongoing correspondence with them. You know, she knew the facts of the case. So she knew some of the liberties that Capote had taken in that book. She watched it happen. You know, she watched him fabricate details or make suggestions to sources or just reshape a story in a way that gave it a narrative coherence, but that maybe strayed from the facts of the case. And so that's the rift you're referring to. And for a long time, people thought that, you know, Capote was mad at her because she had won the Pulitzer and he hadn't, or he was mad at her because Mockingbird was such a tremendous bestseller, or there were even rumors for a little while that, you know, maybe he had written Mockingbird, you know. And the letters from Harper Lee that I've been able to read, you know, and that I can quote from in the book, actually suggests that it was an ethical rift, and that what really happened is she not only started to question her friend's choices around drug abuse and alcoholism, she also questioned his narrative choices and challenged his journalistic ethics when it came to the story of the Clutter family murders. And part of what's so interesting about this book she was trying to write about, you know, this murder story in Alex City, is that she sets herself up as the kind of anti-Capote. You know, she really tells everybody she interviews, I'm writing a nonfiction book. It's old-fashioned journalism. I just want the facts. I don't want any rumor. I don't want any speculation. You know, I'm not going to stray from the details of the case as it really happened. And it seems to me that that feeling and that kind of assertiveness comes from her reaction to Capote's own work and the culture in general, because, of course, what happened after In Cold Blood came out is a lot more of these stories started to be told. And they were filled with psychological speculation, or they had recreations, or, you know, they took liberties. You know, they inhabited the mind of someone who had been murdered and obviously couldn't have told their story in this way, or they fabricated explanations for why someone who had already been executed might have committed a crime, or they invented evidence of a kind that made the story more satisfying but not accurate. And Harper Lee had these very strident opinions about the difference between fiction and nonfiction. You know, she had herself written a novel and knew what novels were, and she was driven batty when Capote would go around talking about nonfiction novels as if it were a thing. You know, and to her mind, things were either nonfiction or they were novels. So that's some of what she was up to in Alex City, and some of what her letters. She actually maintained a long friendship with Capote's fact checker at The New Yorker, and those are some of the best letters that shed light on her feelings about In Cold Blood, because they stayed in touch and she was able to talk to him about Capote's ongoing relationship to the truth and to, quote, matters of fact.
Yeah, and you're right, and I was just going to say it as you did, is he created the seminal book that now everybody else is this derivative of, that whatever you want to call it, gonzo journalism or whatever, and it can be called a Million Little Pieces or something like that. In fact, when I interviewed Eric Larson, he got really mad at me because I said, oh, well, how do you know these people said that? And he goes, if it's in quotes, someone said it. And he was...
Oh, interesting. When you were talking to him about Devil in the White City.
Yes, exactly. And I was suggesting...
Yeah, it's a fascinating book, and I know, right, he has this very, very specific authorial note about sourcing and where things come from. But, of course, it's also true that right before one of the women is put into the crematorium, you know, he basically inhabits her thoughts. And he notes that it's an aberration from the way the rest of the book operates. So I think that it is, you know, these are important questions. And there are debates that a lot of writers and a lot of editors and a lot of critics continue to have because, of course, you know, there's no one standard for journalism or for storytelling. You know, the way TV operates, for instance, is very different from the way that magazines or newspapers operate. And different writers have different standards, just like that, for what goes between quotes or how you can represent something with certainty. And I think it's all very interesting, and it's one of the reasons, even though Harper Lee was trying to write her book in the 70s and 80s, I hope that for folks who still love true crime, that part of the book is very resonant, because they get to learn about a genre they love, and they get to think through some of these issues, which I don't think always have a straightforward right or wrong. You know, there can be, you know, respectable and honorable people can disagree about whether something is a fact or not, or, you know, whether or not you've accurately represented a scene based on the kind of police report or the autopsy or something like that. So I don't mean to suggest that, you know, Furious Hours or even Harper Lee had all the answers, but I think she was asking the right questions. And I think that they're really important ones to wrestle with, both as, you know, people who create these things and as people who consume them.
Well, you know, not to, and I don't even know if what I would say to you, to anybody, would be a spoiler in this book, but I guess based on the, when you bring her back in towards the end of the book, I guess the question a lot of people would ask would be, why didn't she write it? And was part of the reason why she didn't write it because she didn't feel that she could do one or the other, either do it totally accurately or take liberties?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I know what you mean. It doesn't quite count as a spoiler because there's so much in the book that operates at the level of emotion and not suspense. And I think that's one of the things, right? Obviously, if Harper Lee had published a book called The Reverend, everybody listening to this podcast would have already heard about it.
Right.
And, you know, if a full manuscript had emerged, they would have heard about that too. So it's not as if we're giving it away to say that she never published this book. But I do think there's a really enduring mystery to whether or not she wrote it. Because a lot of people in her life who are very close to her, you know, friends and family and people she talked to about this book, including Gregory Peck, who she had a wonderful ongoing relationship to and to whom she wrote these very interesting letters about this book she was calling The Reverend. You know, there are a lot of people in her life who would say they think she wrote it but chose not to publish it. Now, both of those questions, whether or not she wrote it and whether or not she had any intention of publishing it, hinge on the kinds of issues you're getting at, which is, was she ultimately not satisfied with the amount of facts she could gather? Was she ultimately unhappy with the kind of story she would have been telling? Which, you know, again, for the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, let's contextualize it for a minute. She was going to be writing a book about a black serial killer, about black-on-black crime, about a kind of racialized violence that was not representative of its time and place. And for the woman who had given us the story of Tom Robinson, telling the story of Willie Maxwell would have been a very political decision. So there was a lot going on in the kind of particularities of the case, but there was also a lot going on in her personal life. So I think the reason, you know, you mentioned earlier a reviewer who was kind of emotionally gripped by Harper Lee and really moved by her story, I think on top of the specifics of this case is just the drama that will be familiar to anyone who has tried to write a book, which is the hard work that is writing. And Harper Lee really struggled with it. And she struggled with it not only when it was a book called The Reverend, but she struggled with it with every book she tried to write. And she was consumed by perfectionism and writer's block and the kinds of difficulties that, you know, confound you no matter what you're trying to write. And that's the story on top of the story of this book. You know, that it's not just this true crime case that stymied her. It's really, it's the life of a writer who never quite figured out how to do it again.
Yeah, and you and in the reviews and in the book, it's like, and her friends and existing relatives found it risible that when you asked, or anyone asked, did she keep a journal? Did she keep a diary?
Oh, God. Yeah, so for a long time, you know, I'm sure, you know, if you interview reporters, they all have this kind of dream, you know, dream list of things they'll find or a kind of wish list of sources. And for me, early on, someone had said to me, like, they thought Harper Lee kept a diary. So it was one of these things I asked friends and relatives of hers and neighbors of hers. And over and over again, these people, you know, it was my dream to find it, because if it existed, it would finally answer all these questions about her life and her work. But of course, the more people I asked, the more they would say things like, oh my gosh, she was allergic to any kind of self-reflection. Or, are you kidding me? If she had kept a diary, it would have been like seeing a psychotherapist, which she would never have done. Or, you know, there is no way she would have written down her private thoughts for fear the world might find them. So, yeah, they did not, not many of them signed on to the possibility that there's going to be a, you know, posthumous diary of Harper Lee.
Well, given that, and that goes, I think that goes back a little bit to the idea of anguish as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that is why Harper Lee's life is so tragic. The thing she loved most and the thing that she found most meaningful is the thing that was hardest for her to do.
And that's
writing.
Right. And the idea was I'm speculating, but it seems like there must have been so much inside that didn't never came out, you know, that there were all these books, all these ideas, all these that just were in there. You know, it's like I was just in Florence and I was looking at the Michelangelo's Four Prisoners, you know, and how he said that, you know, the stone is not there. It's just, the people are inside the stone. You just have to carve away everything that isn't the stone.
That's beautiful, and that's Harper Lee, right? Like, here were these giant, giant pieces of marble and mist and all of the kind of native Alabamian stones, all of these stories she wanted to tell that she kind of never figured out how to peel away the rest of it and get to the heart of the matter. And I think the kind of list of books you're thinking of is this amazing letter she wrote these friends in the late 50s, and it was her writing plan for the next 15 years. And you know, we all underestimate Harper Lee. That list is wild and interesting and could have been a whole career for someone. You know, there are the obvious novels. She wanted to write another race novel. She wanted to write another novel about Monroeville. But she also wanted to write a novel about the United Nations.
Really?
A novel about, quote, India 1910. And then a novel, she was really enamored with Graham Greene, this British writer. And, of course, she says, you know, she wants to write what Graham Greene calls an entertainment, which is basically a thriller. And, you know, here's the young Harper Lee just thinking she's going to write it all. And I think that's the kind of stuff when you read it all these years later after her death and you sort of realize all the things that kept her from producing work, that's where the story takes just truly a tragic tone. And I think it's hard, you know, it's hard for people who loved her, who wanted nothing more than for her to be successful and figure out how to write. It's hard for those of us who were so shaped by Mockingbird, because all we want is for there to be, you know, surprise manuscripts and, you know, more and more books to emerge. And I just think it's one of failure. And it's one of the reasons, to tell you the truth, I actually think it's sort of worth dwelling on, because so many of us pretend to be okay with rejection, but actually we love the triumphant lives and we love the prolific writers and we love the writers who never struggled. And here's Harper Lee, actually purely human and struggling with writing every day and really trying to figure out a way through. And those stories are worth looking at too. You know, it's a life worth thinking about, even if there was only the one book.
And the funny thing is, you think of her, okay, the reclusivity and this idea that she didn't want to be interviewed, she didn't want to be in the public eye, she didn't want to be photographed, she didn't want any of that stuff. And you tend to think of that in tandem with the absence of further work by her. But then, suppose you write two more books, one about J.D. Salinger and one about Thomas Pynchon. Thomas Pynchon, for example, you know, no one can find him except his voiceover in The Simpsons, for God's sakes. And but he writes and writes and writes. So they're two separate things.
Totally. And of course, I think with Harper Lee, I hope that, you know, here we are kind of making the book sound like a real downer. I hope that one of the joys of Furious Hours is realizing just because someone doesn't want to do an interview with the press doesn't mean that they're not living a full and interesting life. And as far as Harper Lee goes, especially when she was doing this reporting for the book she was going to publish about the Maxwell case, you know, the people who met her in and around Alex City, where these murders happened, say she was down to earth, but one of the most interesting people they ever met, that she was comical, that she was, you know, gregarious, that she was just the most interesting person they ever encountered. And the same thing is true. You know, I was able to find hundreds of her letters and quote from them, you know, a lot in the section of the book that's about her. And in those letters, you just hear this incredibly comical, satirical voice, full of life and vitality. And so again, just because she didn't want to be interviewed by the New York Times doesn't mean that she wasn't thinking interesting things and going interesting places and living a remarkable life.
Do you think that, here's a question, and it's partially answered. I mean, she had this correspondence, this wonderful correspondence with many people, but did she have friends?
Boy, that is one of the best questions I've ever been asked. And I think you're getting at a really interesting tension with her, which is, right, here she was able to go into any room and charm the pants off people. Hmm. It's what she did in Kansas for Capote. It's what she did in Alex City. It's what she did over and over again in Manhattan when called upon to do it. And yet the people who were closest to her often couldn't answer fundamental questions about her. And the best example of that is people who knew her for decades who could say nothing about her writing life. And when I say nothing, I mean, you know, I would press them, did she write with a pen or did she write with pencil? Do you remember, you know, did she write in the morning? Did she write in the evening? These very basic questions that you might even know about, you know, the person who works in the study carrel near yours in the library, or, you know, a colleague you can't stand in the office. People who knew Harper Lee for decades couldn't answer those questions about her because she was so closed off. Or I think another one of the personal questions I often get asked about during book events, you know, was she gay? People who knew her very well have speculative answers to that question, but they can't say with any certainty. And I think that that kind of closed offness, that kind of reserve, makes it very hard to love someone or befriend them. And that's why, you know, again, it's a great question. She had these wonderful correspondences. She had people she would visit with in Tuscaloosa and New York. She obviously had, you know, intellectual stimulation in the form of correspondence. But I think it's a different question. Did she have friends? You know, were there people who truly knew her well? Because I spent a lot of time looking for them, and then the most likely candidates were often people who were humble enough to say, you know, these are the things I know about her, but there was a lot I didn't know.
And that's funny.
And that's different from being reclusive.
Yes.
You know, again, as you talk about different categories of reclusive writers, I think that that is very different from reclusive. That is someone who is pathologically private. And I think, again, those are important things to think about with a writer like Harper Lee. What kept her closed off from the world? And, of course, it's obviously related to why she had difficulty producing more work.
And it's funny, you know, once again, it goes back to my thought previously that you bring the reader into the book, because then the reader has to decide, well, this reader, you know, okay, are my friends my friends, or are they something else? You know, and then what is a friend? And it becomes part of the reader's process. You've let go of it. Your only child is now let go and let out into the world, and he or she has to do whatever she's going to do, and you're no longer there. And that's what's so fascinating about it. And especially since...
Yeah, and I think, especially when it comes to true crime, on the one hand, not answering questions is really unsettling. You know, if you write a book about a murder and you can't say for sure who did it, you leave readers with a lot of existential angst and uncertainty and discomfort. But I think those kinds of refusals, you know, the kinds of renunciations, when it comes to something like Harper Lee, like, quote, why didn't she write another book? Well, maybe no one will ever know. And the most responsible thing you can do is give your readers all of the information so they can draw their own conclusion or derive their own theory of the case, as it were. And that's one of the things I hope with Furious Hours. You know, I've gone and done all this reporting and gathered all these letters and done all these interviews. But sometimes the most honest and straightforward thing you can do as a writer is say what you don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Not to impugn her, but here's a classic Terry Gross question. Because they're all like these kind of questions. Okay, so if you could meet her now, if she'd be willing to meet you and have dinner, what would you, and if you thought she was going to answer these questions, what would you really want to know? What would you want to know? I mean, you know her.
Yeah,
now.
I mean, you've just given the essential caveat, which is you could force her to answer, because of course all of these kinds of hypotheticals are contingent on the truth serum that makes the person in question tell you everything.
Yeah, which is
and, you know, right. So, okay, what would I ask her? I mean, look, I think that there are really fundamental questions about her life. You know, I would want to know the kind of quotidian, when did you write and how did you write every day? What did you do with your manuscripts? Those kinds of material history questions. And then I would ask the emotional ones. Why did you want to be a writer? Why did you find it hard? You know, why couldn't you find a way through writer's block? And then there are a bunch of really specific questions I would have for her about the Maxwell case, because there are people who were alive when she was investigating this case who were dead by the time I found it. And that includes the other two main characters of the book, Tom Radney, the lawyer, and Willie Maxwell, the reverend. And, you know, she wasn't able to interview the reverend, but she was able to interview his widow. She was able to interview some of his siblings. She was able to interview his mother. And I think that those are people, you know, on top of all of my kind of deep and existential questions I have for Harper Lee about her own life, I have all these really specific ones about this case and what she learned at the time, because she was digging around this story decades before I ever found it. And, you know, the letters I have from her talking about these characters and the facts of the matter are so interesting and so informative that I have to think a couple of hours of sitting to talk to her about the case would shed a lot more light on things. You know, who did she think helped? How did she think this happened? What poison did she think used? You know, how many of the insurance companies, you know, were never recorded in the court records? How much money did she actually think the Reverend managed to get off these policies? Who else besides his widow does she think was involved? You know, all of those questions, which have nothing to do with Harper Lee's kind of personal life or life as a writer, but they're infinitely fascinating to me because I spent so much time thinking about this true crime story, too.
It's funny. It brings to mind two things I've always thought about. There was a Saturday Night Live sketch about Richard Nixon sitting down to begin his memoirs, and he goes, "Richard, My Life by Richard Nixon." And then you open it up, and he goes, $29.95. And that's his first line. And then the other one is, I have this friend, Adam Pelsman, who wrote this really good book called Troika, and he has a new book out now, too. And the first time I interviewed him, he says, "Yeah, I've written seven novels, and they're all in my bottom, you know, bureau drawer." And I'm thinking, I couldn't do that. If I wrote it, no, I want it out there. But I like.
It's really tricky, this business of manuscripts, and you know, I think it has a lot to do with whether a writer is a perfectionist or not. So again, there are a lot of writers where, right, we don't have to wonder because we know anything they wrote, including their grocery list they put on their blog or they published.
Right. It's
but then you meet writers like that, or writers like Harper Lee, where there really is the potential for there to just be manuscript after manuscript that sort of didn't meet the standard of publication, but that they couldn't bring themselves to destroy.
Yeah, and well, that's the thing. Like, if you look at, say, JoJo Moyes or the woman who wrote Gone Girl, I've forgotten her name.
Oh, Gillian Flynn. Yeah,
Gillian Flynn. It's like all their back stock, no matter how far it goes back, they just do another cover that looks exactly like the cover of Gone Girl, and all these old books are now bestsellers. It's hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, that's basically the kind of Ghost at a Watchman story, right? Like, again,
right, exactly.
It was packaged as if it were a subsequent book, but it really is the kind of, you know, it's the back page stuff. It's the stuff she wrote before. It might as well have been packaged with, you know, the couple of short vignettes she wrote for the college literary magazine or the kind of hysterical political columns she wrote for the student newspaper at the University of Alabama. You know, it was really, it's not quite juvenile.
It's like what they did with David Foster Wallace, you know, publishing The Pale King. It's like, and that's the way, being the cynic I am, is what I thought of Ghost at a Watchman. I just thought someone, the estate, the family, just said, you know, we can still make money off of her, you know. That's just the way I thought about it. That was the way I looked
at
it.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking earlier about the kind of ethics of true crime and how you tell other people's stories. I just think, again, the kind of, you know, the way we handle writerly careers or that we tend to the reputation of any given writer is another set of interesting questions. And I don't think that there's always a right or a wrong, or that the same right for one author is necessarily the right thing for another. And I tend, you know, when people ask me about Ghost at a Watchman, to bring up this book I actually really love, which is crazily called Edgar Allan Poe and the Jukebox. But it is a long-winded title for the drafts, fragments, and kind of manuscripts of poet I love, Elizabeth Bishop. And Elizabeth Bishop was a total perfectionist in her lifetime. She published very little work. There's just a few volumes of poetry. And everything she wrote, she slaved over. And, you know, she would leave one word out of a sonnet for years until she figured out just the right word. So you may think, going back to her drafts and fragments and the things she chose never to publish in her lifetime, would be a violation. And of course, what actually happened is this beautiful book came out of it, where people like me, who already loved her work and wanted to know more about her process as she drafted, as she revised, as she worked with editors, or even just kind of figured out how language could work, it's a beautiful book that makes clear these are things she chose not to publish, but that we're gathering together for you to learn from. And it's a little bit more of a scholarly enterprise. And it's not the kind of book that will make anyone love her work if they don't already, but it's the kind of book, it's like a biography. It just teaches you so much more about a writer you love. And I think that's what Ghost at a Watchman could have been. It could have made us even more grateful for the beautiful novel that is To Kill a Mockingbird. It could have told a much more complicated story about Harper Lee's politics and her relationship with her father and been honest about the political history of this country. But instead, it was offered up in a kind of commercially successful way that just made, you know, that sold more copies but didn't tell the full story of the book.
Yeah, it's like if Max Brod had listened to Kafka's Last Request, we wouldn't have the trial, we wouldn't have America, we wouldn't have the castle, we wouldn't have Metamorphosis.
Right. So on the one hand, you violate the writer's wishes, the explicit and expressed wishes. On the other hand, literary history benefits. But it's important, you know, even if you publish the trial, you want to acknowledge Kafka's feelings about it. So again, that's why I just think it's a very complicated set of decisions. And I admire the kinds of, you know, literary estates and publishers who have to make these decisions. But I just think they have a lot of tools at their disposal. It's not simply a, are we going to put this between two covers or not? It's how are we going to package this? What kind of information are we going to give to the readers? What kinds of introductions or annotations are we going to give them so that they have a context for this? And that's just, for me, you know, the thing I wish could have happened. Even just, you know, we have such capacities now to go through and look at kind of line by line what changed between these two novels, or to add in letters. You know, there are these wonderful letters from the 50s and 60s where Harper Lee is talking about her dad and talking about the politics of the South and looking at how racism operated outside of lynch mobs. And if you had added those in, you know, I just think it would have left people with a very different experience than what they had from Ghost at a Watchman.
Well, with that, let me just say two things. One, and then we'll close out. One is that I have an independent bookstore. Your book is on the front table and doing very well. And the other thing is that, and it's kind of like what we're talking about, but actually a little off, is that one of the things that really makes me happy in the bookstore is when some kid comes in and gets up on the library ladder and is looking for a specific book, but he also sees the book on the left and the book on the right. And one of those books might be the book that changes his life. And I think that's kind of what you did here. And because no one ever expected your book, right? I mean, it's just, it's not what anyone expected to read or, and like I said, all the reviews say it, it's just that they didn't expect Harper Lee to be introduced to us in such a different way. So thanks so much for writing it. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciated talking to you today about it.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of fun. And, you know, I just think independent bookstores are such a remarkable institution. And, you know, you talk about children finding a book. Of course, what we all find in these places are friends and new ways to think about the world. So it's just been a total honor to get to talk to you and to know that the shop is there kind of providing that space and those opportunities every day.
Yeah, and I think you just gave me a definition of what a friend is, a book.
Oh, God. I know. It makes me want to go, like, read Anna Arendt or, you know, someone more philosophical on friendship. You know, it's not a problem for Harper Lee. It's one of these things, anytime you start thinking a lot about a thing you think you understand, it, of course, becomes more complicated, and friendship is one of those things.
Yes. Well, thanks again. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye. We were talking with Casey Sipp, whose book, Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, gives us a whole new perspective on an author that, you know, even after Ghost at a Watchman came out, this is a different thing altogether, because she worked so hard on writing this book and then never wrote it. And Casey tells the story of what the book would have been, but then she also, and as I said, the reviews all praise this, she introduces us to Harper Lee and talks to us about her, as the epigraph says, her anguish that extends to all of us. And it's a different kind of book, and I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed talking with her. So as usual, this was a great find for us, and I thank Rebecca for searching it out, because I probably wouldn't have found it. So keep coming back. We have these really cool books coming up. Zwan Juliana Wang is going to discuss her book, Home Remedies, and then Arcady Martine, joins us to discuss, which is what I love, her latest science fiction book. Well, actually, it's her first, but it's going to be a trilogy, called A Memory Called Empire. And it just goes back to nice, hard science fiction that you used to read when you were a kid, or at least I did. And, yeah, it's a really good book. And I specifically asked for that one because I knew I love science fiction. Anyway, thanks as always for joining us, and we will see you again next week on The Avid Reader.